Okay, so this is the first of the courses that are taking place in the first 3 weeks of the summer school. This is an introduction to the trace formula. As I say, it's going to be difficult in 15 weeks. Ideally, what I would like to do is to motivate the subject to you, although there are some experts here, but to motivate the subject as well as make you familiar with some of the techniques in it. Well, in 15 hours, it's rather difficult to do both of those things, but I will try to have a balance between those two aims. So let me just give you a couple of references. There are two sort of introductory books on it. They don't go perhaps as far as one might like, but one is by Shokranian, and it's Springer Lecture Notes, 1503-1991. Another is by Steve Gelbart, and it is in an AMS series, the University, called the University Lecture Series. Volume 9, AMS, 1996. And I have, and this was right at the beginning of the subject, but I have a survey article in the Corvallis Proceedings, that's these you probably you're familiar with them. Those are these symposia of pure mathematics. This one was number 33, volume 1. That's also AMS. And that's 1979. And pages 253 to 274. Oh, very good. Oh, that's wonderful. Okay. Well, so the Corvallis Proceedings, so it was just noted that they exist on the AMS website. They can be downloaded. They're difficult if you're just getting into the subject, but they have, by and large, pretty good articles on just about every aspect of the subject. So that is a very good reference, the whole proceedings. There's two volumes of it. Well, let me just begin with a very general problem in group theory. In its most general form, abstract form, it could be, it's the following question, where you have a discrete group gamma embedded as a subgroup of a locally compact group H. And I'll assume that it's also unimodular, by which I mean that as a locally compact group, it has both a left and a right Haar measure, and unimodular means that the two are the same. Most of the groups that one is familiar with have that property. And the basic object of interest in this situation is the regular representation R of H on the Hilbert space L2, so it's very sort of stated very abstractly at the beginning, on the Hilbert space of square integrable functions on H mod gamma. So H has a Haar measure on it. That gives rise to a right invariant measure on the space of right cosets on which H acts by right translation, R of Y of a function phi is the right translate of phi by Y. Well, the problem then in this situation, stated in very general terms, okay, this is a unitary representation of the group H. One has the notion of an irreducible unitary representation on a Hilbert space, one that has no closed invariant subspaces other than the whole space and the trivial, the zero space. That's an irreducible representation. And the sort of general abstract problem is to decompose R explicitly, or as explicitly as you might be able to, as explicitly as possible, into irreducible representations. So the way one might think of it, one might think of this problem in the context where perhaps you know, perhaps a more elementary question you might already have the answer to, you might have a classification of the irreducible representations of the given group H. That, of course, has nothing to do with gamma, but then putting a discrete group gamma into it makes it more difficult, deeper question. And so the question then is, of your list of irreducible representations here, which ones are going to occur, and how often, and in what form, in the decomposition of R? So you will be very familiar, any sort of beginning graduate student would be familiar with the basic example in which gamma is the additive group of integers, and R, H, is the additive group of real numbers. And then the process of decomposing R into irreducible representations is exactly the theory of Fourier series. Well, just keeping sort of with this general picture, a strategy for attempting to investigate this problem would be to, rather than look at the operators R of X or R of Y, to average these operators, average R against a test function, say a continuous compactly supported function on H. And so it's easy to see what one gets by doing that. R of F is then the operator that sends a vector phi in the Hilbert space to the new function, new vector, whose value at X is the integral over H of F of Y, R of Y, average the operators against F, integrated over the group, so that this is then the integral over H of F of Y, B of X, y dy. Now, we've assumed that the dy is both left and right invariant, so I can translate x for this integral as a constant, so I can translate by x to the minus 1 by the fact that we're also dealing with a left-hand measure, And so I get the integral over h of f of x to the minus 1 y, c of y, dy. And the invariant measure on the quotient, h mod gamma, is by definition the measure such that the measure on the whole group is the product of the measure on h mod gamma with the sum over gamma. So in other words, this can be written as the integral over h mod gamma, and then the sum over gamma in gamma of f of x to the minus 1 gamma y phi of gamma y dy. Well, the advantage of doing that, of breaking the integral over h into a double integral, is that phi by assumption is a left gamma invariant vector, so that it doesn't depend on gamma. We can remove the gamma from that integral. And so we reach the conclusion that this operator R of F, obtained by averaging the vectors in the the operators, the unitary operators in the representation against the function f, that this in fact is an integral operator. On this space, L2 of H mod gamma, with a kernel k of x and y, that expression in the brackets. The sum over gamma, f of x to the minus 1 gamma y. Of course, there's no problem with convergence in any of these things. I've assumed that f is of compact support, so in particular this sum, gamma, might typically is an infinite group, but for the purpose of this sum, x and y are both constant. The support, they amount to translating the support of f, both on the left and on the right, by a constant. So you're talking about the sum over gamma in a discrete set against a function that's compactly supported. So that, for any given x and y, is just a finite sum. All right, so one would like to perhaps use this fact that you have a rich family of operators gotten by taking arbitrary test functions on the group, each of which gives rise to an operator with a rather explicitly given kernel. There's a following special case that is particularly where one can go immediately, one can go further. It's the case, a case that arises often, but by no means always, where the quotient H mod gamma is compact. So I'm going to regularly have to state things. I won't have to be able to prove everything from first principles. I will try to state things which I don't prove in such a way that they're plausible, or give you examples. And again, I think I believe that it's quite possible to work in this subject, and I guess other subjects, where you carry certain things, treat certain things as axioms until you have a chance to really to prove them. So in particular, in this case, there are two facts. Actually, these are not terribly difficult. But in the case that we've assumed that our H mod gamma is compact, then there are two facts about it. First of all, R decomposes as a discrete sum of irreducible representations pi of H with finite multiplicities. And so by that I mean that this Hilbert space, you can break it up into actually an orthogonal direct sum of subspaces on which the restriction of H, invariant subspaces, on which the restriction of H is irreducible, and moreover, up to equivalence, a given irreducible representation occurs in this direct sum with at most finite multiplicity. So this actually, one could either look it up, or one could even try to prove it oneself. It's an application of the spectral theorem for compact operators. Compact self-adjoint operators. Namely, the operators R of S. Well, typically R of F would not be self-adjoint, but if you take a function whose conjugate, such that F of X bar is equal to F of X to the minus 1, then you check right away that R of F is a self-adjoint operator. And by using the spectral theorem for those, the fact that you have an integral kernel there on a compact manifold, it means that R of F is actually of Hilbert-Schmidt class, which is stronger than being a compact operator. So in particular, it's a compact operator. So you have a whole host of compact operators, R of F, and one can, in fact, show that using the spectral theorem that one can get this theorem from it. So in other words, this means that R is a direct sum of irreducible representations pi with multiplicities a pi of pi. So a pi, the multiplicity, is then, of course, it's often zero if you're summing over all irreducible representations, but in any case, it's a non-negative integer. The second fact that comes from the case that the quotient is compact is that for depending on the group H, for a large class of functions F, not only is R of F of Hilbert-Schmidt class, that's essentially the definition of what it means to be an integral operator of that form, a stronger condition, but it's actually of trace class. So for good functions F, R of F is of trace class, and its trace is the integral of the kernel over the diagonal. This, for example, is true if H is a Lie group and if F is a smooth function, because then you would be talking about a kernel, an operator on a compact manifold given by a smooth kernel. And by the theory, for example, using a partition of unity and reducing the question to the case just of Fourier series, one shows without much difficulty that this is true in that case. That is to say, an integral operator on a compact manifold given by a smooth kernel is of trace class, and its trace is the integral of the kernel over the diagonal. So let me make that assumption. So let's assume F is good. And then what we get is that the trace of R of F is then the integral of H over H mod gamma of the kernel on the diagonal. So that's the sum over gamma of F of X to the minus 1 gamma X dx. So that's something that one can manipulate with. It's reasonably explicit. Notice that if I put absolute values here, I would be integrating. This is compact, and this is a finite sum for any given x and y. So, in fact, after summing over gamma, I get something that's continuous in x, and I'm integrating it over a compact set. So this is an absolutely convergent double integral. So I can manipulate it any way I want. I can rewrite those integrals any way I feel like and still be assured that they converge by Fubini's theorem. And so let's do that. All right, so this is going to be the integral over H mod gamma. So let's break up the sum over gamma. It's a sum over all elements in a discrete group. We can break it up. We can partition that sum into a sum over the different conjugacy classes in gamma. So let me sum gamma over a set of representatives. So by this I mean conjugacy set of representatives of conjugacy classes. And then for any given representative of a conjugacy class, you'd get the whole conjugacy class by summing, by conjugating that element, summing over gamma modulo the centralizer. This is the centralizer in gamma of little gamma. So this would be f of x to the minus 1, delta to the minus 1, gamma, delta of x, dx. Well, let me take the sum over the conjugacy classes outside. So a sum over a set of representatives of conjugacy classes. And then let me take the integral inside. So if I take the integral inside, I've got an integral over H mod gamma paired with a sum over delta in gamma modulo something smaller. So I could write this, if I take this inside the sum over the conjugacy classes, I could write this as the integral over H, not modulo gamma, but combining the integral over X with the sum over delta. Well, I know there are some experts in the audience, so I apologize if I'm going a little slowly, but we'll do it in two steps. That's the integral over H mod gamma, the sum over delta in gamma gamma mod gamma, f of x to the minus 1, delta to the minus 1, gamma delta x dx. All right, so then we can combine these two in the form of one integral. So that would then become an integral over h modulo the smaller discrete group, gamma of f to the minus 1, gamma x dx. And then that's in reasonable form, but I would prefer to separate the contributions. I'd rather have integrals that really depend as meagerly as possible on the fact that we're dealing with a discrete subgroup. So to do that, why don't we do the following? Let's sum over gamma in conjugacy classes, and then we'll break this up into a double integral where we take h gamma modulo gamma, and then we'll just integrate over h mod h gamma. So this, of course, is the centralizer in h of gamma. And so that's f of x to the minus 1, y to the minus 1, gamma yx dx. If we do that, then h gamma, anything y, so this is dy dx. So y is in h gamma. It commutes with gamma. It simply comes out of the integral. And so that this is equal to the sum over a set of representatives of conjugacy classes of a constant, a gamma, the integral h mod h gamma of f of x to the minus 1 gamma x dx, where a gamma is the volume of gamma sub gamma divided into h gamma. So I'm using implicitly, of course, I'm using Fubini's theorem implicitly here to make all of these rearrangements of the integral, but I'm also using the fact that any Haar measure can be written as a product of an invariant measure on the group modulo a unimodular subgroup, and then an invariant measure on that unimodular subgroup. And how you decompose the given Haar measure as a product, it's not unique. If you multiply the invariant measure by a constant, you're going to have to multiply the measure on the other space by 1 over that constant. But that doesn't matter. It's just it's implicit in writing something like this here, that we've got an invariant measure on h gamma and a corresponding invariant measure on this quotient here, the product of which is the given Haar measure on the original group. So if you multiply the measure on h gamma by a constant, then you'd have to divide this measure by the corresponding constant. So in any case, choosing consistent measures on the various coset spaces, we get this formula for the trace of R of F. So our conclusion is that the sum over gamma, set of representatives of conjugacy classes in the discrete group of these constants, these coefficients, these volumes of these centralizers modulo the intersection of that centralizer with gamma, that's what the A gammas are, of an integral, which I'll write as F sub H of gamma, so that's equal to the trace of R of F. On the other hand, I'll write this down in a minute, but this is the integral here. On the other hand, R of F, we have it over here. R is a direct sum of irreducible representations, each occurring with finite multiplicity a pi. And so from the point of view of the original problem that we pointed out, it's these multiplicities a pi, which are to be regarded as the unknown things, the things we want to find information about, and we then they appear then. The trace of this operator R of F is F, these invariant subspaces, well, they're invariant under the operators R of F. So the trace of the whole operator is simply going to be the sum over pi with multiplicities a pi of the traces of the operators pi of F. I'm going to write these as F sub h of pi. Okay, so this is where F sub h of gamma is the integral over h mod h gamma of f of x to the minus 1 gamma of x dx, and f sub h of pi is the trace of pi of f. In other words, the trace of the operator obtained by integrating f of y against the irreducible representation pi. So this is so this formula was pointed out by Selberg 40 years ago. This is the Selberg trace formula for compact quotient. Yes. Do I have them in the wrong order? I think it's okay. You mean here? I think it's all right. I first have to integrate over y in order to get... oh, there's something wrong here. Yes, you're right. I need to rewrite... I first have to integrate over y, so this, you're right, thanks. This should be the integral over h gamma, modulo gamma gamma, and then this is the integral over h mod h gamma. Yes, thanks. And then this is the centralizer in h of gamma. So I have to first integrate over y make the resulting integrand as a function of x be invariant. Left invariant under h gamma. Now, these the point, I guess, of doing this is to try to separate. So what do we have here? These things, these are linear forms in the test function f, and they are very fundamental objects. As a matter of fact, at the same time that Selberg pointed this out, Harish Chandra, I guess, working at the same place, well, certainly later, at the same place that Selberg was studying these things intensively in their own right, without any relation to automorphic forms. He was interested in harmonic analysis on semi-simple Lie groups. And these things he called orbital integrals, these distributions. And these he called, or they're, he called these things irreducible characters. The point being that typically, if H is non-compact and non-abelian, the irreducible representations pi, irreducible unitary representations pi, are infinite dimensional. And so you cannot, pi of x then would be an infinite dimensional unitary operator, and its trace would have no meaning. But what Harish Chandra, right at the beginning, I guess, of his work pointed out, was that if you average such an operator against, in the case of real Lie groups, a smooth test function, you do get an operator that is of trace class. And so he called the trace of that operator, regarded as a distribution in the test function. That was his generalization of character theory. The character theory that occurs is a big part of the theory of representations of finite groups. So this is then an irreducible character, and this is an orbital integral. So what is this thing then? It's kind of dual. I mean, these are sort of really fundamental objects in the hands. They became really fundamental objects in the hands of Harishchandra, and they were dual in a kind of natural sense, where these things were the generalizations to, say, real Lie groups. They would play the role in the study of representations of Lie groups that the conjugacy classes play in the study of representations of finite groups. So we're used to thinking of representation theory of finite groups as being kind of a duality between irreducible characters and conjugacy classes. The two objects, for example, form two separate bases for the space of conjugate invariant functions on a given finite group. I mean, they really are dual in many different ways. And these two kinds of objects are the generalizations of these things. So this, I guess one can refer to this as the geometric side of the trace formula, and this as the spectral side, because in the case, one of the things that Selberg applications that he gave was to the case where the group was SL2R that acts transitively on the upper half plane. And if you choose a function f on that group that is invariant under the maximal compact subgroup of SL2R, you get a function on the upper half plane. And so this could be regarded as an identity that relate, on the one hand, a discrete group gamma with compact quotient in SL2R amounts to giving a compact Riemann surface. This side represents the eigenvalues of the Laplacian on that Riemann surface. And this side, not hard to show that these elements gamma here represent the closed geodesics on the Riemann surface. So in that sense, this really is kind of a geometric side, and this really is a spectral side. So in sort of most general terms, one would like to try to get information about the A pi's from the geometric side of the trace formula. Well, there are two special cases of this that are quite familiar. So in the example I mentioned earlier, where gamma is Z, additive group sitting in H equals R, then the trace formula for compact quotient, even just in this integrating without, it's a non-abelian group, so you don't need any of the second half of the analysis, it simply reduces to the Poisson summation formula. Another example is where you would take H to be any finite group, and gamma to be simply any subgroup. And then the trace formula for compact quotient. And again, actually, you really only need to use it in this form, the integral over the diagonal, without these additional steps. But if you look at what it actually says, it amounts to a special case of Frobenius reciprocity. For representations of finite groups, which says that if you have an irreducible representation of a subgroup gamma, and you induce that up to a larger finite group H, then the multiplicity of any representation, irreducible representation pi of H in that induced representation is the same as the multiplicity of the original representation in the restriction of pi to gamma. And this formula hands you that in the special case where you're taking the trivial representation of gamma. So it's actually the special case. The trivial one-dimensional representation of gamma, and you would simply take f of x to be the function, well, the character of an irreducible representation of pi of x. Irreducible representation of h. And then by the orthogonality, so you'd have to know a little bit of sort of the general theory of representations of finite groups, but the orthogonality relations for characters of finite groups immediately tell you that the multiplicity, this representation R in that case is then the induced representation of H, representation of H obtained by inducing the trivial representation of gamma. And this formula tells you that the multiplicity of pi in that representation is the same as the multiplicity of the trivial representation of gamma in the restriction of pi from H to gamma. So already it's the trace formula for compact quotient is a very neat way to generalize some pretty standard but important things in more elementary mathematics. Okay, so that's as a general sort of question, and one gets this formula in that case. Now, automorphic forms really are the study of this general problem in a more specific case. So automorphic forms general automorphic forms concern the question of the study of a general reductive algebraic group G over a number field. So as I mentioned, Fiona is going to be describing the main theorems that are used for these objects. We're not really assuming that you're familiar with it. We can, if you wish, you can really, without losing terribly much, you can simply regard G as being the general linear group. And in fact, I will quickly specialize the case, really without any loss of generality, I will specialize to the case that F is the rational. So the general linear group is, you can think of, is an algebraic group. It's an object that assigns to any commutative ring that contains the rational numbers, it assigns a group, namely the set of invertible n by n matrices with entries in that ring whose determinant is a unit in that ring, thereby allowing you to take the inverse of such a matrix and still having a matrix with entries in the given ring. That is to say, any ring that contains the ground ring, say the rational numbers. So that's the setting for general theory of automorphic forms. And it fits into the above picture by letting gamma be GF. And that is supposed to be the discrete group. So if you're not familiar with this, that looks a bit strange. That doesn't look like a discrete group in anything. Rational n by n invertible matrices don't look particularly discrete. But you would like to embed that as a discrete group in some locally compact group. And what is the locally compact group? Again, I guess this is something that we're sort of a little bit assuming that you're familiar with, but let me just review the construction of how you get a locally compact group in which GF embeds as a discrete group. In fact, I'll just review it in the case that F is equal to the rational numbers. And then, well, we first recall that a Q comes with an absolute value. It has the usual absolute value. Which number theorists index with a symbol infinity, V infinity T, or with the infinity absolute value of a rational number T. And as one does when one's defining the real numbers in a first sort of analysis course, you take the completion of the rational numbers with respect to this absolute value. And you get the real completion as in the sense of equivalence classes of Cauchy sequences in the rational numbers, two Cauchy sequences being equivalent if the limit of their difference is zero. But then what we recall that our here not sort of a basic background in basic number theory, that we note that Q also has some other absolute values. It has a p-adic absolute value. V sub P of T. One for every prime number P. And by exactly the same process that you define the real numbers as the completion of the rational numbers with the original absolute value, you can do the same thing for this other absolute value. And you get another completion. Q sub P, known as the field of p-adic numbers. The completion of a field is a field also, and so this is a 2p, the field of p-adic numbers. So we're just recalling that if the p-adic absolute value is obtained by taking a rational number, reducing it to its lowest primitive fraction, in which p has been taken out of both the numerator and the denominator. So either there's a positive power of p or a negative power of p. Then the p-adic absolute value of t is p to the minus r. This is for t, any rational number. Non-zero rational number. Two rational numbers then are very close in the p-adic absolute value. If, let's say, two integers are very close in the p-adic absolute value if their difference is highly divisible by p. So you can just you check that this absolute value satisfies the same properties, the requisite properties of an absolute value. Namely, it is multiplicative, and it satisfies the triangle inequality. And therefore, you can just go through the process of completion and get define the p-adic field. As a matter of fact, not only does it satisfy the triangle inequality, but you just, by inspection, you see it satisfies a very strong form of this inequality. T1 plus T2, the p-adic absolute value of a sum of rational numbers, in fact, not only is less than or equal to the sum, but in fact it's less than or equal to the maximum of the two. And in fact, what this means is that the unit interval, or rather the set of p-adic numbers of norm less than or equal to 1, that's a compact subset known, written as ZP, so the set of p-adics, of absolute value less than or equal to 1. That's closed under multiplication, clearly, because the p-adic absolute value is multiplicative. But because you have the strong form of the triangle inequality, it's also closed under addition. So that this is actually, so closed subset of 2p is actually a subring. It's the maximal compact subring of the p-adics. It's an object that's a new thing that arises for p-adics that doesn't arise in the case of the reals. And what it in fact allows you to do is to, so you'd like to, one wants to put all of these different completions on the same level. One wants to put them all together to form a larger ring. But now we want something that's locally compact. We're trying to get a locally compact group in which GQ embeds discretely. And all of these fields are non-compact. They're all locally compact. The completion, just like the reals, they're locally compact fields. But none of them is compact, and there are infinitely many of them. So if I took the direct product of these rings, with pointwise multiplication and addition, I'd get a ring all right, but it wouldn't be locally compact because a product of infinitely many non-compact spaces is not going to be locally compact. However, because of the existence of these things, there's a little device, a little, you can sidestep the issue. We will put, one puts these together. One puts the locally compact fields QV together. As what's so-called a restricted direct product. And that's defined as follows. It's known, it's a subset of the direct product, which is closed under pointwise addition and multiplication, and therefore is a ring, subring of the direct product of all of these things, known as the ring of Edels, attached to Q. So it's a restricted direct product of all of the completions, and it's customary to write V for the completion of an arbitrary valuation. So in other words, this would be the direct product of the reals with the restricted direct product of all of the p-adic completions, and it is defined as the set of all elements at T with a component in each of the completions. So TV is in QV, but with the restriction that for these P's, for almost all of these P's, that is to say all but finitely many, we ask that TP actually lie in this maximal compact subring for almost all P. So that's closed under addition and multiplication. And you can see that what you can do is you can fix a finite set of valuations F, including the reals, and then you could form a sub-ring of this obtained by taking arbitrary products within that finite set of valuations. And outside of that, you simply take the direct product of all of these maximal compact sub-rings. So that would be compact. You'd be taking a product of infinitely many compact spaces with finitely many locally compact spaces. So that's locally compact. And then you would just simply take a direct limit over these finite sets S as S gets large. And then with the appropriate direct limit topology, you get something which remains locally compact. Okay, so this is known as the ring of Edels. And so this is the Edels of Q. So this is a locally compact ring. And notice that the rational numbers for almost all P, a given rational number, will not have any P in its numerator or denominator for almost all P. So a rational number is in, well, first of all, the rationals embed diagonally. They embed in each of the completions, but for almost all P, a given rational number will, in fact, satisfy this condition. So it embeds diagonally. And one checks that, in fact, is a discrete subring. So in the case of GLN and the rational numbers, we've gotten a larger ring, the ring of Edels, and it's a ring that contains Q, and so we can talk about the group of general linear matrices with entries in this larger ring of Edels, and there is a discrete group. There is a locally compact group which contains GQ as a discrete subgroup. Okay, so that's the setting. Those are the Edels, and we'll pick up from there tomorrow.